Okay, so today's speaker is Professor Kees van der Pyl. Kees was a lecturer in international relations at the University of Amsterdam and from 2000 until 2012 professor at the University of Sussex in the UK. He is a published author, having written The Making of an Atlantic Ruling Class, Global Rivalries from the Cold War to Iraq, The Discipline of Western Supremacy, Flight MH17, Ukraine and the New Cold War, and his latest book, States of Emergency, Keeping the Global Population in Check. He has edited several collections, most recently, The Militarization of the European Union. And today, Kees has come to present on his latest book, which is, again, States of Emergency, Keeping the Global Population in Check. So thank you so much, Kees, and over to you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for the kind introduction. Indeed, I'll be speaking about this last book, although, of course, events move very fast. And the book is mainly about the COVID crisis, but the COVID emergency is now subsiding, as far as I can see. But the title of the book is therefore even more appropriate. It's States of Emergency, so there are successive impositions of states of emergency, obviously, and that is because the real cause of this crisis, just as it was in the case with the crisis of terrorism after 2001, and probably with the climate crisis, with the forms of scarcity that are being introduced. The idea is always that there's a mass of an enormous mass of people in the world who can no longer be controlled. And by control, I mean in the first place that there's no stable job relation for waiting for them. You know. Now I'll first speak about the crisis and then about who is driving forward the transition that the crisis also entails. And finally, I'll come to a few positive things, you know, because the information revolution that is behind, that is the transition that's really involved here. The information revolution also has a promise for a better society. Just as book printing at the end of the Middle Ages, as it were, introduced or enabled an era of democratization beginning with the church reformation. So now the IT revolution makes it possible to have a truly transparent society and political order and economy. And actually, it also solves a few philosophical problems that probably would take us too far. But first about the crisis, you know, it's a crisis of, well, monopoly capitalism, transnational capital, however you want to label it. And it's important to see that the crisis as such, of course, was not planned. There's a popular discourse now in which people like Klaus Schwab, you know, the oracle of Davos, is being cast in the role of a sort of Dr. Evil who all along had a plan and so on and so forth. But that's not how it works. It's a system event. That means the real plan is actually a product of a whole network of forces who have only a degree of conscious control of aspects of the whole situation. And yet, also at the systemic level, you can say that there is a situation to which the whole constellation tends. And that, in my view, is best labeled as ultra-capitalism. Now, ultra means that you're looking at an extreme form of something, in this case, an extreme form of capitalism. But in the term ultra, in the Latin word ultra, you also denote the fact that it drives beyond that phenomenon. So ultra-capitalism means it's an extreme capitalism, and on the other hand, it's already showing particular features of a society beyond capitalism. And Orwell, George Orwell, in his phenomenal novel, which is actually getting more topical by the day, 1984, he refers to the term oligarchic collectivism. And I think that nicely captures the aspects of this ultra-capitalism, because it's collectivism for the masses after the elimination of the property-owning middle class, especially the economic property-owning middle class. So farmers here in Holland are being threatened with radical expropriation. Fishermen, shopkeepers, etc. They were all the victims of the COVID lockdowns. Also, the whole restaurant owning middle class was victimized in that situation. So, collectivism for the vastly enlarged property-less population, and on the other hand, of course, the oligarchy, which is the billionaires and the multi-millionaires, and of course, a layer of cadre of people who work for these rich people. Now, this ultra-capitalism itself is the cause. The fact that you have the oligarchy next to the large expropriated mass of people leads to all kind of confusion. Many people are now referring to these policies of expropriation and radical enrichment, on the other hand, as communism. They label it left. And that is, in my view, a very negative development, not just, as a schoolmaster that I'm annoyed with the abuse of terms, but also because by constantly attacking the left and everything associated with it and the notion of socialism, this sort of discourse also blocks the perspective of social change, because it suggests that there is nothing beyond the current society. But I just mentioned that on the side. Now, the reason why there's such a powerful drive to a large property-less mass of people in the world is because after the shift of China to capitalism, which was really taking off in the 1980s, and the collapse of Soviet-style state socialism, in the decades that followed, there was an enlargement of the wage-dependent population available for capitalist exploitation from 1.5 billion to 3 billion, even 3.5 currently. So there's an enormous wage-dependent population available, and at the same time, due to certain aspects of the IT revolution, digitalization, use of computers, miniaturization, and so on, for 1 to 2 billion people, there's not a prospect of a decent employment. So we're looking at a situation in which a large part of the world population is superfluous, but also, especially after the crisis of 2008, the entire world population, so people with reasonable prospects and people without any prospects, have become restive. So after 2008, 2010, that's really the breaking point. So 2008, the moment of the financial collapse, you see a sharp rise in strikes and popular unrest of all kinds, you know, riots, also anomic unrest, fighting, riots, occupations, not always, let's say, progressive developments or developments that we should be very enthusiastic about. Personally, I don't believe at all in these regional separatisms like Catalonia or Scotland. But for the ruling class, it doesn't matter whether an opposition movement is really organized and has a plan, or whether we're looking at just unrest in a more general sense. They are facing an unruly world population, and that population has to be controlled. And that's a process that already began in the 1990s when various think tanks began thinking about how to control a world population that was no longer willing to settle for a steady existence, or for whom nothing was in store any longer. Because don't forget that in 1991, when the Soviet bloc definitively collapsed, capital was also unleashed. So its most nefarious forms, like speculative capital, took over from the more long-term aspect of investment, the investment cycle, let's put it that way. So we're looking at an unruly world population, and that takes me to the second aspect. That's the IT revolution as the moment of transition that is involved in this crisis. And that the IT revolution, as I said, it's in itself is a very positive development, or a potentially positive development. But as with every innovation, it's always the ruling class first that puts his hand and puts the innovations that we're talking about to its own, tries to instrumentalize them for its own good. And what it does in the current crisis is to turn the crisis, as I said, which is basically a collapse of the previous type of monopoly capitalism, the ravages caused by this dominant speculative form of capital, and so on and so forth. And what the ruling classes do, the ruling classes and the governments that work for them, is a flight forward, basically. So they try to turn the information revolution to their advantage. And basically what they want is that before the masses can converge around meaningful alternative forms of political order, to introduce what you might call a preventive counter-revolution. And that has as its central concept, again, the notion of control, you know, keeping the global population in check. And in the book, I argue that at the center of the classes that, or class fractions, you know, a class is never a sort of static social layer. It is a process of class formation in which various fractions, so various sections of the larger capitalist class, move forward and converge, partly intentional, partly by accident, converge into a common block. And the group that currently, in my view, leads the whole process, or the process to gain control of an unruly world population and move towards this ultra-capitalism, is on the one hand the intelligence services. You might say they are always involved, but in this case they're specifically important because the IT giants like Google and Apple and Microsoft and so on, specifically were either a product of the intelligence needs of society. You know, Google is a direct outcome investment and by the intelligence services to use electronic means to know more about the population, the so-called total information awareness, or if they developed outside that connection, like Apple, They were later brought into collaboration with the intelligence services. So the intelligence services, the IT giants that partly emerged from that part of the state machine. And the third component is the multimedia. It's often forgotten that in the 1990s, when capital briefly began to rule the world, and everybody thought that we would forever be in the end of history, as Fukuyama propagandized it, there was also legislation to encourage media ownership to become more concentrated. And so the multimedia giants of today are also part of that block of intelligence services, IT giants, and the multimedia, the Disneys and Verizon and so on. And what they want to do is to apply, and that's the ultimate project. Again, as I said, such projects should not be traced to a single source, but they emerge, as it were, from the convergence of a number of separate actors who encounter each other and collaborate with each other in the process. But basically what they want to achieve in the end can be summed up as artificial intelligence connected to a human biomass of, I think almost 8 billion people now. So basically what they want to achieve is to turn that control, the necessary control, if you're faced with an unruly world population, you have to control them. Now, you can't put a policeman behind everybody, but we have now with the IT revolution, the means to observe and to surveil every single person, certainly in the more advanced and electronically equipped parts of the world. And I say human biomass because there's a fourth player, and that is the biopolitical complex. And in the book, I make the case the pharmaceutical industry and the hospital sector, which of course is not everywhere as privatized as it is in the United States, but it's clearly on the way of in that direction elsewhere too. But I use the term of Foucault, the biopolitical project or complex. They see humanity as a biomass, I wouldn't even use the word patients, but as a biological substratum of society, which they want to apply, to which they want to apply their specific insights. And there I use the term that Naomi Klein came up with, which is disaster capitalism, that every disaster in our type of society is followed by the formation of a group of large companies who, through privatization or any form of preferential treatment, are brought in a position where they are going to capitalize and to profit from that disaster. And I would say that the pharmaceutical companies especially, and the whole medical establishment that has become dependent on them and basically is being blackmailed by them, are the disaster capitalists of this situation. So while on the one hand, it's that triangle of intelligence, IT, and multimedia that drives the process towards a surveillance society, it's the biopolitical complex that gives it the vaccination twist. And that again reminds you of the fact that what they try to achieve with the vaccination drive is to get into that into the physical reality of the that vast mass of humanity. So in the words of Bill Gates, we will not be safe until everybody is vaccinated, and that's really, there's really a philosophy behind this this idea. The reason why this is turning out into a disaster, and that reminds you of the fact that these are, let's say, parasites who jump to the occasion, trying to exploit it to their benefit. But the reason why it's turning out into a disaster, with many people dying, you know, the frightening numbers of people, young people also are dying as a result of the vaccination, is because what they are applying as technology is premature. For instance, Moderna and Pfizer and the biotech companies with which they are working were planning to use, for instance, the mRNA vaccines as a cancer treatment. And that was in its early stages. But when the COVID crisis broke out, and in the book I explained that that has a lot to do with bio labs for biowarfare, but that would take us too far now. When that crisis broke out, the opportunities, financial opportunities that were created by the COVID crisis were so tempting that they shifted from, or they switched in one go from the cancer research to a COVID vaccine using that novel technology, or the technology that Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca use, which is essentially identical in the sense that it also stimulates the body to produce spike proteins itself, but it uses another method, that the consequences were not necessarily the consequences that the triangle of intelligence, IT giants, and multimedia had in mind, because what they had in mind was electronic ideas, total surveillance, total information awareness. But the pharmaceutical companies turned that into a disastrous, prematurely applied, innovative vax campaign. That's my reading. Otherwise, I can't make sense of it. I don't believe people who say that, you know, Bill Gates all along had the plan to reduce the world's population. Well, he may have had that plan, but if that would have been a plan, it would have been much smarter to start something in Africa, because that's really the population bomb in the current world situation, if you want to look at it from that angle and use these terms. But not, you wouldn't target North America and Western Europe, because from the sort of point of view that you can imagine to be behind plans for reducing the world population, it would be a very self-defeating approach to take that area. I think it's really an unforeseen consequence of the premature involvement of the pharmaceutical industry in this whole process. Now, that takes me to the fact that the COVID crisis is actually subsiding. I think it's really capsizing. Too much is becoming clear of the consequences of the vax campaign. Too much resistance is evident to a surveillance society. But you see also certain politicians who already begin to reorient to a situation away from the pandemic panic, like the far right new prime minister of Italy, Meloni, who is of neo-fascist origin, but is also a member of the Aspen Institute, which means that she converses with the top bracket of the United States and the Atlantic elite, basically. But Meloni, in the fourth day of her government, rolled back all the measures that had been taken under Draghi, her predecessor, to force people in Italy to either take the vax or be fired and lose all your benefits and so on and so forth. And she has rolled that back. The same has been has been decreed by the verdict of the New York State of New York Supreme Court, which also has said that people in the hospital sector and so on who were forcibly were under compulsion to be vaccinated, and if they refused, they would be thrown out. They have done the same, I think, even before Meloni came with her rollback order. And there's also this new prime minister of the Canadian province of Alberta, who also has not only denounced the discrimination against people who were not vaccinated, but also has indicated that or really expressed her decision that she didn't want to work with the World Economic Forum in any way, given that this body was bragging about the number of governments under its control. So you might say the COVID panic is subsiding, and what is also very interesting is this article that appeared in the Atlantic Monthly in the United States, where somebody suggested that since we didn't know what was really happening and what was really behind the COVID affliction, we should now call for an amnesty. You know, everybody should be forgiven what they did and what they said. Now, that's an impossible proposal. Not only is it a completely immoral proposal, but it's also impossible because the consequences will be with us in the coming years and maybe even longer. So just as the terrorism scare subsided somewhere in the middle of, you know, let's say 2005, 2010, so now the COVID scare is subsiding, and that means that some form of new state of emergency will have to be formulated. And I think chances are that it will be a climate state of emergency, but it also can be connected to the introduction of a new financial system. The complete expropriation by the abolishment of cash payments, etc. The point is that just as the terrorism scare didn't have anything to do with security and the COVID scare didn't have anything to do with health, it was always about control, controlling the world population. And that means that a climate lockdowns, which are very much to be expected now, but also the state of war. I mean, let's not forget that NATO is fighting a war in Ukraine with Russia, and it's very well, it's completely plausible that at some point, unless we get a very rapid turn to negotiations, but it's very well possible that war also will entail not necessarily lockdowns, but further restrictions of people's rights, the right to travel, all aspects of mobility. But also, let's not forget, restrictions on the freedom of expression, which of course are massive. And I think if you look at these different themes on which states of emergency are based, then through them runs the idea to get people to become holders of electronic IDs. In Europe, that's very obvious that people want to connect you, even physically, you know, and here the injection route is so important, even physically to electronic identification. And whether we're talking about terrorism, talking about the pandemic, talking about climate or any other aspect, it's the ID aspect which is really the red thread connecting these different options to the need to control the world population and bring it into a state of, well, slavery is maybe not the best word, but it's the one that pops up now. Make it malleable, controllable for the oligarchy and its security apparatus. Now, as I said, I wanted to end with a positive note. As I said, the IT revolution is a radical change. The whole world is walking behind phones, reading them all day. Well, you can find that annoying, etc. But it has, of course, incredible potential for us as people who write books and do research. Something that would take months and months of work in libraries, writing to people, you name it, can today be done in an afternoon with all the risks involved there. But you see what I mean. To have the world at your fingertips is an amazing innovation. And that means that the potential to have a different political system, one of based on complete transparency, to have a different economic system, one based on digital planning, and also complete transparency of all the decisions that lead to choices involved in planning, are now within reach. Of course, as I said so far, we are not in a revolution of that kind. We are in the counter-revolution that seeks to prevent it, because if there's anything that the ruling class in its collective, as a collective entity, is understanding, it is this democratic potential of this IT revolution and the danger of transparency. And if you ask me why, for instance, somebody like Julian Assange is in prison, not just in prison, in my view, he's being killed in prison, or maybe like Gramsci in the 1930s, he will be let out in just a month or so before he would die of the consequences. Of course, we all hope it won't come that far, but it looks like it. If you want to know why he is behind bars, it's not, as you sometimes hear, for a free press, because there's no free press anymore. Although maybe tactically it's right to make that connection. But it is because he showed, WikiLeaks showed, as did Snowden, of course, from a different angle, what transparency can mean, what a revolutionary force it is to know everything about what politicians are doing, what sort of economic planning is going on behind the scenes, and so on and so forth. There's only one example, and that was after the Russian Revolution, when the Bolsheviks published all the documents of secret treaties that had been concluded and had contributed to the actual outbreak of the war. And there you see the connection between transparency and revolution, and also the democratic potential of that transparency, because it's open to everyone. Now, the question, of course, and in the book I make some suggestions, but would take too far to go into that now. But the question, of course, is who will bring this new situation about? And given the tremendous potential for repression that current governments have, and the fact that all the governments of the world are now involved in the collective state of emergency that was pronounced first for terrorism, but even far more comprehensive and effective in a way in the name of a virus. And I think what we're seeing now, and that's the last thing I'm saying, is that the basis for an alternative society are being laid on a small scale. I mean, I can only speak of my own. I'm a regular speaker here in Holland for all kind of groups who are resisting government policies in various areas. And the one thing that you see recurring is small scale initiative to arrange the direct supply of food, clean, biologically grown food, from farmers who are part of the movement here in Holland, at least, and going from food to health, because of course the health sector has been completely discredited by how it behaved in large majority in the COVID crisis. And I think these small scale initiatives in in food supply and in health provision are about to branch out to include forms of payment, forms of pricing exchange and so on and so forth, but also education, because you can't grow your own food and organize your own health system without also beginning to think about what you have to know to function in contemporary society. Now, whether we will ever get a chance to witness the establishment of such an alternative society is a different matter, but I think that is the ray of hope that we should be seeing now. And it might well be that what now are marginal and very limited initiatives might suddenly blossom and become far more comprehensive once the COVID collapse, which I see now, so the collapse of the state of fear and state of emergency based on the virus scare, once that collapse is completed, you might see a sudden growth of people who are interested in these alternative routes, and that might have political consequences, and certainly it's something that many of us are.